You're listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business. I'm Austin Meek of WacoBusinessNews.com, and today my guest is J.B. Smith of the Waco Tribune-Herald. J.B.'s covered the news in our town since 1997, which means he's seen plenty of ups and downs in his two decades on the job. We dive into his history, favorite stories, and his views on what our downtown really needs as we build on this current upswing. But before that conversation, it's the word on the street. The Cotton Belt Bridge is a steel truss structure that links the sides of the Brazos in between I-35 and Franklin Avenue. Built in 1907, it was at one point part of the Texas and St. Louis Railway, which ran from Bird's Point, Missouri, all the way down to Gatesville. During World War II, Japanese prisoners of war were allegedly transported to Fort Hood along the line, which served as a major commercial point for 20th century Waco. The railway stopped passenger service in 1952, but real estate developer Rick Sheldon and his wife Lisa hope to bring it back to life.
Rick and Lisa Sheldon, over a series of trips to New York, really were inspired by a famous bridge, the High Line, which has become so much more than a bridge. It's a connector, it's a park, it's a destination. And areas around the High Line have transformed in terms of economic and community development. And it's not just about dollars. It's about community. It's about this being a place where people gather and spend time and encounter each other and have a wealth of different activities and experiences. And it's so much more than just a bridge.
That was Megan Henderson, executive director of City Center Waco, and she's right about the impact of the High Line. Recycling that railway into an urban park completely revitalized Manhattan's Chelsea neighborhood, which was in poor condition even into the 90s, but it's now one of the hottest rents in New York City. It also spurred real estate development along the line and raised values of adjacent properties by 10%. The Sheldons are hopeful a similar impact can be made here, so they donated the bridge to City Center Waco. Henderson led a public meeting on Tuesday, seeking input from the community on how to best utilize this unique asset.
Not only the most likely uses and the most important uses, which may not be the same things, but also about the most potentially impactful uses. Are there ways that this space could change downtown or change the spaces around it?
The Wallace Group has created three proposals for the bridge, renderings of which can be seen on our Waco Business News Facebook and Twitter feeds. They all show the bridge as an active space, joining East Waco and downtown, and creating another connecting point in the city's growing trail system. City Center Waco really wants to know what you think, so be sure to find them on Facebook, Twitter, or on their offices at Elm Avenue, and let your voice be heard. Countless times on this program, I've mentioned the need for more entertainment options in downtown, and hey, somebody was listening. Waco Escape Rooms, which opened on Lake Air Drive in 2015, debuted to the public last week in their new downtown location at 711 Washington. If you've never heard of the concept, an escape room is a physical adventure game in which players solve a series of puzzles using clues, hints, and strategy to break out of a space in a set amount of time. At Waco Escape Rooms, your friends and you can choose from four different storylines and attempt to break out of the room before the clock runs out. The rooms differ based upon number of people, difficulty, and theme. There's a full article with pictures and interviews with the founders on WacoBusinessNews.com, but the TLDR version is that the business outgrew their first space and wanted to be a part of this downtown renaissance. Corey Dickman, co-founder and operations manager of Waco Escape Rooms, is a Baylor grad who moved to Portland after his schooling and had been looking for an excuse to get back to Texas. He's made the most of his return, launching a new business and chairing 1 Million Cups, the entrepreneurial program that's hosted at the Waco Hippodrome every Wednesday. He's investing in downtown Waco with his time and money, and I encourage anyone looking for a fun activity to check out Waco Escape Rooms on Washington, next to Wildland Supply Company. There are few people who know as much about what's happening downtown as J.B. Smith. As a staff writer for the Waco Tribune-Herald, J.B. tracks downtown business and city affairs, keeping a pulse on both the private and public people powering Waco's economy. JB joined me in the KWBU studio this week, and before we got into the nitty-gritty of his day job, he talked about how he ended up in Waco. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So I love starting off the show by asking my guest what their Waco history is. I know you've been at the Trib for a while now. Tell us a little bit about your time here in Waco.
Yeah, I came here in late 97 from Georgetown, where I'd gone to college and was working at the Williamson County Sun, and I was looking at some other kind of mid-market newspapers. So I came up to Waco. I didn't really know much about it other than what I'd seen from Interstate 35.
And what year was this?
This was late 97.
Okay.
So, you know, it's this November day with kind of this fading light of November. And downtown at that time, I parked my car. I remember this, parking my car near the Trib and just all these kind of shuttered down buildings and vines growing up the buildings and onto telephone wires and thinking, hey, this is kind of cool.
You've always had a love for the dystopian, haven't you?
Right, yeah. I think what I saw then, I had this sense that downtown Waco, that there used to be something there. You know, like there was a real history there. There was a city there. And having been in small towns most of my life, I kind of wanted that urban experience. And so I was going to kind of make that happen, whether it was real or not. And I think now we're seeing that happen. But what really sold me on Waco was I drove back the weekend after I interviewed. I told the city editor, who was at the time was Becky Gregory. I told her, you know, I like the paper, but I'm not really sure about Waco. I don't really know much about Waco. I'm not really sure about moving there. And she said, well, come on up and we'll just drive around. And so we drove around town. Like, we went all over East Waco down to the lake. And,
wow.
But as soon as we're like going into Cameron Park and turning on the road there, where it kind of goes through all those tall elm trees there. I'm seeing people on their mountain bikes, and then I had to feel like I'm in a state park here.
It hits you like a ton of bricks
yeah.
when you see that.
I'm just thinking, yeah, I could live here. So that was really the turning point. Like, I knew at that moment that I was going to move to Waco.
So you had a sense that there was a city. You know, there was a larger civilization than what you had seen in 97.
Yeah.
Was that simply because of what you were seeing, or was that because you were familiar with the history of Waco? Were you familiar with the tornado that came through?
I did a little cram session the night before I came in and interviewed in Waco, so I could pretend like I knew something about the city, but I didn't really know much about it. I guess I probably did know about the tornado, but of course I've learned a lot more about it since then, and just from writing about it. So that's really kind of how I get to know about anything, is by writing about it.
So is that something that you had done since you were young? Have you always been someone who likes to get the evidence, find the story, and sort of trace that narrative?
Yeah, I think there's two kinds, at least two kinds of journalists out there. And some people are just all about tracking, investigating, and the thrill of the daily deadline and the action, and other people like me, I wanted to be a writer, and so I kind of came late to the idea of being a deadline daily newspaper writer and being doing investigative journalism. And it turns out I love doing that stuff too. But what I really wanted to do was to be a writer, and so. So I just kind of came into it from a different direction.
And is that what you studied when you were in undergrad?
I was an English major at Southwestern University.
Okay, yeah. Terrific.
And so that experience when you get to be you're a senior and you look at it and you realize you're like, this is the summer before my senior year, realizing, oh, wait a minute, I've never really thought about what I'm going to do with this. With this degree. And so I rushed down and got a job at the Williamson County Sun that summer, and that was my introduction to journalism.
You hear stories about how beneficial a liberal arts education is, and no matter what you're going to do, you're going to need to know to write well, and that is 100% true.
I drank the Kool-Aid on that.
Oh, yeah. I did too. I was a creative writing major at A&M.
Right.
I know exactly where you're coming from. But then you do really realize, okay, I can eloquently craft a sentence, but if I'm not getting paid for those words,
right,
it's not doing much good for me.
Yeah, so I was a complete rookie at that, and so I just kind of got my butt kicked every day. But it was a learning experience.
So in 97, when you're here in Waco interviewing with the Trib, what beat were you hired for?
I was hired to be the City Hall reporter, which is what I still am. And I had been the City Hall reporter in Georgetown, and so it was a pretty easy transition. But what I've kind of done since then is expanded that into other areas like environmental reporting, immigration, and then just a lot of in-depth kind of stories about the community that don't really fall on anybody's beat particularly. But those long stories, those long weekend stories are kind of my specialty.
Mm-hmm. Well, you really gained a lot of notoriety during the West explosion. You're one of the first persons on that story. Talk a little bit about the process of uncovering that, and then as some of the evidence came out later.
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't actually even go out there that night. We had other reporters who were doing that. Kirsten Crow, who's now at the Corpus Christi paper, was doing a lot of that work, but I was sort of the next day guy. I guess I'm kind of the next day guy.
Okay.
So I was there the next morning, like at 5:30 and 5:36, and started researching and started calling out. I probably called about 20 or 30 people that day, and found blast experts and found chemical experts. And so I was like, because at first we were hearing that it was ammonia tanks, anhydrous ammonia tanks that had exploded. And I started talking to people who were saying, no, that doesn't make any sense. They wouldn't have done that. They wouldn't have exploded in that way. And so it turned out it was ammonium nitrate, which is a very different chemical and a different fertilizer that's dry. And so so a lot of news outlets were reporting that it was anhydrous ammonia, but in fact it was this different chemical, which we've all learned a lot more about since then. But it's those kinds of things. Like, I don't wake up in the morning wondering about the chemical properties of ammonium nitrate, right? but then you find yourself suddenly trying to become an expert in that, to the extent that you can on deadline.
Perhaps it's because now that I live in Waco, I do read the Waco Trib. This is the first time in my life that I've consistently read a local paper, and maybe it's because
you.
Of that. Thank you. I love the Trib. Maybe it's because of that it seems like Waco has a higher, crazier incident per capita rate than like anywhere. Is there something in the water in Waco, or is that just my perception?
It's been said a lot that Waco's a news town. I mean, I just don't see this happening in Abilene. I don't see, even Amarillo or Lubbock. I just don't see that, like, they have as much news as we do. But, maybe that's a matter of perspective. But we've had some pretty big things happen here.
I mean, is there anything you can point? I mean, is it just simply the location between, two major metropolitan areas? Or is there anything that you could point to why? I mean, there is an article on the Trib this last week about some kid in a penitentiary creating a fireball. And that explosion, released all the other inmates. Like, crazy things happen here, right?
Yeah, yeah. I just have no idea why that is. I mean, maybe it's just the fact that we're on the interstate, we're kind of between the big cities, but not a big city. But we're also not a suburb, and so I don't know. That would be an interesting study.
Maybe your next investigative journalist. So walk me through a typical day right now. So you're still covering City Hall.
Mm-hmm.
You're covering a lot of business, of course.
Yeah.
So what's a typical day in the life of J.B. Smith?
I'm not sure that there is a typical day, but I try to stay on top of just what meetings are going on in a given week. And it's not that I necessarily want to sit through a 4-hour budget and audit committee meeting for the city of Waco, but you got to be there to get the news, right? There's times when I've sat through plan commission meetings on a Tuesday night that were not really exciting, but you get a story out of it. And so sometimes just going to those seemingly boring meetings, or sometimes just going to press conferences, you end up seeing people that might know something that you don't know, not necessarily the topic that's there, but But they, you know, they might say, "Oh, did you hear about what's going on at the hospital or something like that?" Mm. So just getting out in the community, I think, is the biggest. I think is a big challenge, and probably what I would say for a young journalist needs to know is to get away from your desk and get out there and circulate.
So does that lead to different stories for you? You know, you get your leads from random conversations with other people.
Yeah. I mean, cultivating sources is important, and just asking people, well, what else is going on, you know, and running your ideas past people and just seeing what they know about it.
One thing I learned in my time working in College Station and radio and in journalism is the power of the pause.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's something that I try to exhibit here on Downtown Depot when I'm talking with people like you. It's my natural tendency anytime there's air to just fill it up with words.
Exactly.
But really just being a little bit quiet, being subdued, and letting the other person give you more information. It's amazing what people will tell you.
Yeah. There's a great book by Joan Didion called Slouching Toward Bethlehem.
Yes.
That where she in the introduction she talks about that. She says that I'm such a physically small and awkward person that people feel sorry for me and they start saying things that just to fill the spaces, that with not realizing that I'm not necessarily acting in their best interest. And she says that journalists are never acting in your best interest. That's a little bit more cynical than I want to be. But
yeah, I'm gonna assume that you are here under good pretenses. So once again, if you're just tuning in here on Downtown Depot, I'm Austin Meek speaking with JB Smith of the Waco Trib. JB, what are some of the things that you're covering right now that are particularly interesting to you?
Well, it's interesting you asked that on a show called Downtown Depot, because it seems like downtown, like this is really the time to be covering downtown, and it's kind of my beat. Along with Mike Copeland, who's our business editor, he does a lot of stories on downtown businesses too. But at City Hall reporter, all that's kind of woven into, you know, the resurgence of downtown. When I moved to Waco that downtown was part of the attraction as unvarnished and rough hewn as it was at that time. So I was determined that I was going to live downtown. I couldn't really find many. There was hardly anywhere to live downtown at that time, especially within my price range. So I ended up living at Palm Court. This is 1997-98, which at that time is, you know, this historic apartment complex. At that time, it was not in great shape, but it was close enough to downtown that I could kind of pretend like I was in an urban situation. I could walk down to the library. I could, you know, walk down to my bank, whatever, and even sometimes walk to work. But at that time, I mean, Austin Avenue was just really nothing. I mean, it had been kind of prettied up, but other than the Hippodrome, which only kind of occasionally showed plays, there's hardly anything to see there. And so I think more has happened in the last 10 years, maybe even the last 5 years than it had happened in decades before mm-hmm. that. In downtown, so there's so much to see there, and that was what I was always interested in coming here. That's why I came to Waco, was because I was interested in seeing, you know, a city versus just, you know, some kind of suburban nowhere land. I think there's more of a vision now in the community about what a downtown should be, and I think it comes down to a downtown is different from any other kind of part of town. It's not as like a shopping mall, and it's not like the suburbs. It's this unique unique pattern of development where you can walk to a lot of different things within a few minutes. And so walking is really the key, I think.
What are some of the things, as you envision a walkable downtown, that you would like to see downtown, just not even as a journalist, just as a citizen, someone who hangs out in the area? Are there specific services that you wish we would have access to?
Yeah, I think just in general, more density downtown would be good. there's just a lot of parking lots right now. And
there are indeed.
Yeah.
It's something we've been railing against very hard on Downtown Depot. You have to have a dense urban core.
Yeah, and there's always this balance there because, you know, you do have to have parking, and yet when you have to walk for two blocks without seeing anything, it's a really boring walk, and nobody wants to do it. So I think just more things, and we're starting to see that more kind of redensification of downtown. It would be nice to see some. I don't know. It seems like we're getting the retail, that kind of the fun retail, like the ice cream shops and the coffee shops and the movie theater. So that's on a good track. It would be great to see more kind of. It'd be great to see a supermarket or some kind of grocery store downtown.
Yeah, there need to be enough services downtown where you don't have to leave downtown if you don't want to.
Exactly.
You know, and right now, if I did want to go get a baguette, I could go down to the Provender store, or I could go beg Sergio to make a few extra tortillas for me or
Alpha
something.
Alpha and Omega has good ones.
Alpha Omega is an awesome bakery that's now downtown. But you're right. You know, if I need fresh produce, where do I really go to get that?
Right. And I lived downtown for a while at this old apartment complex called Terrace Gardens. And I walked to work then, and I was really like wanting a place where I could just live and basically always bike or walk. And downtown Waco just wasn't at least at that point. It's you know, slowly edging that direction. But to go grocery shopping, you know, I'd have to drive 3 miles. And so it was really like here you are in the center of town, and yet you're having to drive to essentially the suburbs just to do your weekly grocery shopping. But, you know, that's just a challenge that probably every older city has. So, you know, I think we have to be I think you just have to have the market for that before it's going to happen. The people have been saying that we need a grocery store downtown as long as I've been here, but maybe we're getting closer to the point where there's enough rooftops close by and enough income where that kind of thing can happen.
Yeah. Well, we're talking with JB Smith of the Waco Trib. I do want to circle back to a little bit of the city hall work that you do, in covering the decisions that our city council makes and the public improvement district and the TIF board. You know, they've been very active in giving money to developers. What are the primary differences, or what have you seen in the Deaver mayoral residency in terms of the city council's relationship to Baylor or to working with other city groups, where that might have been different from other previous mayoral terms?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that Deaver's been a sharp break from his predecessor, Malcolm Duncan Jr. I think his style is more low key, but he seems to be very informed about what's going on, and you know, allows other people to have a lot of input. I think that this council is probably kind of a negative from a excitement point of view for a journalist. There's not a lot of conflict, at least open. There's not a lot of kind of open conflict like you might see in some towns. I think that most of the time their goal is a 6-0 vote. They want people to. They want to kind of get a consensus before they go forward.
Sure.
Which is, I think, increasingly rare in our political climate today. So.
And do you think that's an order from the top down? Does that come from Kyle Deaver saying, hey, let's get on the same page before we go public with this?
I think that's probably the case. It's going to be interesting to see how the landfill issue is resolved. Because city staff has proposed a landfill in the Highway 84 corridor, and the councilman who represents that area is opposed to it, and so it's going to be interesting to see whether they can get a 6-0 vote on that, or whether there's going to be some, you know, some conflict or some, you know, just there's just different interests there that sometimes you can't avoid conflict in politics. I mean, it's you're representing different people, you're representing different constituencies. So that'll be interesting to see.
Sure. Yeah, you start to realize the detriment of a dualistic thinking, mm-hmm. and that these are two groups that both want what's great for Waco, and yeah. there are probably more than two groups. Obviously, mm-hmm. there are lots of people with various interests at hand. But you just realize the limits of thinking, I'm right and this person's wrong. You have to be able to see the gray. And in my mm-hmm. interactions with Mayor Deaver, he definitely seems like someone who is willing to sit there and listen to the different perspectives.
Yeah.
And once again, this landfill is something that wasn't an issue for the mayor 10 years ago, and it won't be an issue for the mayor 10 years from now. It just happens to be happening right now. Yeah. During the time that Kyle Deaver is mayor. So it's something that's on his plate, but yeah. it comes with the territory. You know, he's in the position to serve. Mm-hmm. He's a public servant. He's not paid a dollar for being the mayor of Waco.
That's right.
So
yeah.
he's really here because he wants to do what's best for the community. And there's a lot of competing voices, and it's hard to balance all that.
Yeah, yeah. I think it'll be I think it'll be interesting to see whether people can, you know, whether the city council can continue to get people to serve in those capacities. I just think it's difficult. I mean, people are very busy these days, and it's just hard to get people to volunteer their time for what that takes.
Well, yeah, I mean, once Waco is not simply this small town that maybe it was 50 years ago, but now it's really growing in its national popularity. And the brand of Waco is mm-hmm. something that has to be protected and has to be monitored. And yeah, it's going to be interesting to see as the profile of these positions continues to grow, mm-hmm. whether we can really continue to have people who are willing to give their time for it, and especially with the vitriol that can come about with making these big public decisions.
Yeah, yeah. It was interesting. A few years ago, there was a time when the county was saying that they weren't going to be able to hold elections for the city, and so a lot of cities were going toward November elections. And this council was very insistent: if we're not going to do an election in November, because that would get us too tied in with partisan politics.
Mm.
So. They actually for at least that year, it might have been 2 years, but at least that year they held their own election, and they're kind of their own, got staffed up for it and everything. So at least there seems to be that commitment to avoid that kind of zero sum game politics that you see on the national and state level these days.
Well, local government is becoming increasingly important, and having transparent coverage of it is even more important today than it ever has been. So, mm-hmm. JB, thank you so much for the beat that you carry there at the Waco Trib, for informing all of our readers about what's happening with our local city council. And thank you so much for joining us here on Downtown Depot.
Well, thanks for reading, and it's been great to be here.
That's it for today's show. And go ahead and connect with us on Twitter and Facebook at Waco Business News and let us know what you thought. We love getting to hear from listeners, and we take your suggestions very seriously. You can also spread the Downtown Depot love by listening to past episodes on the iTunes podcast app or on NPR One and write a review. We'll be back on the first Friday of May with another show, but until then, follow us online for all your local economic updates. I'm Austin Meek, and you've been listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business.